We have a lot of work to do in the next hour and a half, so let me go very quickly. Quick questions. How is it that the step four inventory does not include the positive, our assets, but only the negatives? Because it works without including the positives. If you're writing a step four inventory in which you're just writing down all the terrible things about you, you may want to write down the good stuff. But if you're writing it down just to isolate what your character defects are, and then to imagine a world in which you're living without those character defects, you don't need to write down the positives. And that's the experience of people who use these forms. You don't need to. You aren't going to feel bad about yourself. You're going to understand what your problem is, and you'll get a sense of how to get rid of it. But there are a lot of other ways of doing inventories in which you feel just awful about yourself. And you just sort of say, God, what a horrible person I am. And then that's when people say, well, you should also write the positive stuff. And, you know, my experience is that the faster you do your inventory, the less chance there is of relapse. And if you do an inventory, use a method that makes you feel bad about yourself, your chances of relapsing are going to be pretty good. And if you do an inventory method that takes you a very, very long time, the chances are you're going to relapse. You know, there's a question, you know, have you ever felt lust, disgust? I gotta tell you, that's good for a couple of weeks of writing, you know. you know, there was a 25-page inventory that's going around in the early days in OA How. But it's not used anymore. But it was 25 pages. And those of you who've been in the program a long time, maybe remember the typewritten pages. 10 pages on sex, written by someone whose attitude towards sex was, I would say, prudish at best. And puritanical was, you know. And I just sort of like, it's very judgmental. This is not judgmental. This is really very practical. And the beautiful part about the big book is how practical it is. What makes you think that the third step promises really refer to after step 12? If so, why would they stick these two paragraphs in the middle of step 3? Well, we don't start step 3 until page 63, until the prayer. The first paragraph on page 63, which is what this writer says are the third step promises, and many people say they are, really comes after under the explanation of turning our life over. This is the effect of turning our life over. We don't do it until we get through steps 6 through 9. But if, for instance, the step 3 prayer was at the top of the page and this paragraph that is now at the top of the page were actually below, under this is the how and why of it, you would much more easily understand it to be part of step 3, part of the explanation of turning our will over. I don't want to get into too big an argument on this because it's not important.
Could you just remind us what page you're on?
Page 63. I was just asked this question, so that's my answer. All right, final answer. So, the big book goes now. If you look at all those check marks, you will realize how your mind is so clouded that you cannot think clearly when it comes to compulsive eating and why you keep allowing yourself to go back. And this is the graphic, because of the check marks, very graphic, you will see it. And then the big book says this, on the bottom of page 66, the last full paragraph there. We turn back to the list, for it held the key to the future. We were prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. We began to see that the world and its people really dominated us. In that state, the wrongdoing of others, fancied or real, had power to actually kill. How could we escape? We saw that these resentments must be mastered, but how? We couldn't wish them away any more than alcohol. The big book provides two methods for doing it. We have to get rid of this feeling for people who have harmed us that is in the way of our ability to look at our own character defects. This is not easy, guys, and let me give you the first suggestion from Big Book is found on the bottom of page 66 and the top of page 67. This was our course. We realized that people who wronged us, so this is only talking about people who wronged us, people we've wronged or principles or institutions that haven't harmed us, these are not things we have to work this out with, but people who wronged us or wronged others whom we loved. You know, I was as I said, this guy who maligned my father was someone who was on my list. So the people who wronged us, column one, were perhaps spiritually sick. Though we did not like their symptoms, that would be the second column, the causes, why they bother us. And the way these disturbed us, that would be the third set of six sub-columns, the self-esteem, ambitions, etc. They, like ourselves, were sick too. And here's the resentment prayer. We ask God to help us show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience that we would cheerfully grant a sick friend. Okay, that's the step four prayer. God, so-and-so is sick. Please help me show that person, name the person, the same tolerance, pity, and patience I would cheerfully grant a sick friend. Now let's look at the next prayer is when a person next offended. You just say when a person next offended, and then there's a prayer there. So this prayer helped me in a lot of situations, but not in all of them. So I'll go through this prayer, and then I'll talk about the other method that the Big Book provides, the famous page 552. There are people in this world and in our lives who do things and we who do things hurtful and we understand. Children will say, "I hate you, mummy." And you will understand that they do not really hate you, but they are saying something hateful. A person who is in constant pain and is so grouchy because he or she is in constant pain may lash out at you, and you understand because that person is in constant pain. People who have certain brain issues, Tourette's syndrome, a brain tumor, may come out with things that they don't even know they're saying, and that may be hurtful. And you would understand that because you would know that they have brain tumors or that they have Tourette's syndrome or something of that sort. People who aren't taking their medication or are mentally ill, who aren't taking their medication, you would understand if they aren't taking their medication that they say things that they don't mean in their innermost core. If you excuse people you like because you understand where it comes from, who have hurt you, then think about people you don't like in the same way. They're sick, sick people. They suffer from a lack of spirituality. The vast majority of people who abuse were themselves abused. You know, the work that I've been doing, I told you about the residential schools. You know, I could trace generations of people who were abused, who then abused, who then abused, who then abused. The Big Book nowhere speaks of forgiveness in this context. Because, and I'm glad it doesn't, although it's very important. Forgiveness is used Forgiveness is used in two ways. One of them is the way I would use it, which is, you owe me no more. There's no more debt between us. You don't owe me anything, whether it's money or the hurt that you did is gone. The Big Book never talks about that. I mean, if people don't show remorse, why in the world should I forgive them the debt? If someone continues to harm other people as he or she harmed me and isn't sorry about it and doesn't try to make up for it, why in the world does that person's actions require any forgiveness at all? They still owe the debt. On the other hand, forgiveness is used very often, and certainly in some religions, as you're no longer on my mind. You're not going to kill me anymore. You're off me. I'm not dealing with you anymore. You know, you're left to your own devices. If that's what forgiveness means to you, then that's what forgiveness is. That's what the Big Book is talking about. But the Big Book never says that you have to forgive someone a debt that he or she has not repaid. Whether it's a, you know, the abuse or whether it's money or anything of that sort. I think that's really important to understand. The second thing I want to talk about in that connection comes from, it's again on the topic of forgiveness, a rabbi who wrote in a book that's very good on forgiveness. Anyone wants to know, I'll tell you privately. But he says that within Judaism, and he's much more of an expert than I am, you cannot forgive someone for any harm done to anyone else. You can only forgive for harm done to you. And therefore, the murderer can never be forgiven, not even by God. And I found that a very powerful concept. He said the only hope a murderer has, or the only hope anyone who has not been forgiven or can't have forgiveness can have, is that by the time he or she dies, he or she is a different person from the person who did the act. That person has been transformed into another person. I like that concept. It makes sense to me because that's what our program is all about. All the sicknesses that we have can be transformed into a different person, a person with a personality change sufficient to overcome compulsive eating. We have the distinct advantage of being brought to our knees by our addiction and learning that we have to change who we are in order to get out of our addiction and to reach some kind of resonance with our deepest values and keep that pipeline open. So we have available to us what a lot of people do not have available. They are doomed to die as they lived. And it is pathetic, at the very best pathetic. It is sad, pitiful, that these are people, the more harm they do, the less they are human beings, or the best of what a human can be. And although that doesn't take away the hurt from you, it at least provides you with a window into them that might allow you to accept that what they experience was sickness and hurt and deprivation and all the kinds of things that go towards doing horrible, horrible things and justifying them as somehow they're right. That doesn't work for everyone. It didn't work for me for Hitler. It didn't work for me for this lawyer who betrayed me, because he really, really betrayed me. Betrayed my trust. And it certainly didn't work for many of my friends who were sexually abused as young people, as children. Page 552 then. In both the third edition and the fourth edition. This is written by a woman whose name was Wynn L. She had a few last names. And she lived in California. And she wrote this wonderful story. And it was about having been sober for 20 years and knowing that she was going to drink because she had not yet dealt with her mother. And she had a resentment that she had to be free of and she couldn't get rid of it. She didn't know how to do it. And one day a friend of hers gave her some magazines to give to a hospital and she looked through them. And one of them, and I can now say with certainty that it was Guidepost magazine and that the article was by Norman Vincent Peale because I heard her give a talk. I heard a recording of a talk she gave, in which the word resentment was a banner on the article. And this is what Norman Vincent Peale said, at least what she says he said. This is what she remembers he said. I've never seen a copy of the article, but this is what she gave credit to Norman Vincent Peale, who wrote The Power of Positive Thinking. You have a $5 bill and you keep saying, what would Abe do? You know, have any of you ever read Power of Positive Thinking? I did, you know. Hello, Mr. Jones from Arkansas, you say, so you always remember that Jones comes from Arkansas. Anyway. Anyway, he did a lot of good things in his life, and certainly page 552 is one of the great things he did. If you have a resentment you want to be free of, if you'll pray for the person or the thing that you resent, you will be free. If you will ask in prayer for everything you want for yourself to be given to them, you will be free. Ask for their health, their prosperity, their happiness, and you will be free. Now, he was part of the sort of the prosperity Christianity that would say that what you want out of life is prosperity, happiness, and health. But if you really think at this stage in your spiritual development what you really want out of life, I'm not sure it's going to be health, prosperity, and happiness. Certainly for me, it was something else. What I wanted out of life at this stage, and what I still want, I wanted serenity. I mean, I had gone through these step four forms and I was full of resentments. I was full of this horrible inability to handle reality, to deal with the past that was not going the way it should be going. I wanted to be serene. I wanted to have the sense of calm that allowed me to look at foods and not want them. I wanted to be useful in life. I wanted to have a sense of purpose and meaning in my life. And I wanted to be able to love and to be loved without feeling bad about myself or bad about what I was doing. I mean, these were essential elements of what I wanted out of life. I don't know what you want out of life. It may be prosperity, happiness, or health. But if you think about what you really, really want out of life, and then you pray for the people who have broken you to have those things, you will realize they have none of those things. Anyone who can hurt someone else without feeling bad about it is a broken, hurt person who has no serenity, who has no love, not only isn't able to love or to be loved, but creates hate and is not only not useful in life, but is disastrous in life, destructive in life. And when you and I did this with Hitler. And I mean, I have no right to forgive Hitler even if I wanted to, but the man died completely unserene, unloved, real love. We're talking real love. And being destructive. This lawyer, you know, when I looked at his life, four marriages, kids from the first two marriages wouldn't talk to him because of how he had treated their mothers, a drunk, smoker, died early. Just pathetic. Very great lawyer. The skills were incredible, but all used to bad purposes. A guy for hire. No principles. And I was able to look at them in ways of pity, sickness. I believe, although I don't believe in a heaven or hell or anything like that, I believe that as you die, you relive your life. And if you're reliving your life, and that's a moment of eternity for you, you know, that's sort of like you review your whole life and it's as if you're in this moment of eternity. And I want to live my life so that by the time I die, my eternity will be serene and loving and a sense of usefulness. And I don't believe these people will have anything like that or had anything like that in their lives. I've talked about that with people who have been sexually abused, and it helped them. I hope it helps you. I don't have any more to say about that other than to say that the more you think about them as sick, sad people, the more you're able to sort of say, all right, they are confined to their own hell. Whatever that hell means to you, it's a hell. And I'm not going to live in that hell anymore, and I'm not going to let them live in that hell. There was a woman many, many years ago who was abducted from, who was kidnapped by a crazy, awful person who sexually assaulted her for 4 days near Death Valley and then cut off her arms and left her to die. And she escaped, and she was able to get help, and he was put into jail, I hope for the rest of his life. And she was asked 10 years later, must have had a great therapist, don't you hate that man? And she said, that man took 4 days out of my life. I'm damned if he's going to take any more. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a grace to that. You know, I saw her interviewed 20 years later, and she wasn't quite at that stage of serenity, but 10 years later she was. And there's a grace to that that many of my friends who have been victims of sexual and physical abuse have reached, that those people aren't going to continue to kill them, because that's what they're doing. And it's in the past. And they have to start looking at their role in allowing the past to continue to kill them. They're part of it. They can't change what happened. It happened. What can they do to change themselves and their reaction to what happened? And part of the process is looking at those people as sick, sad, sometimes tragic, but certainly pathetic people who are no longer fit to be called humans, in a sense. Do you know what I mean? Like the best of whatever we can be in life. They have none of that. They're on the negative side of the ledger. So that's the best I can do for you. And I there's nothing else I can say right now. At this point, though, we're faced with this question. If we can put them out of our minds, can we start to look at our own character defects? And the big book says we can. And they say, referring to our list, page 67, just a minute. Okay. Referring to our list, again, putting out of our minds the wrongs that others had done, we resolutely looked for our own mistakes. And that's where these dotted lines are supposed to go. They're supposed to cross out, supposed to bend this over like this. So you put out of your minds columns 2 and 3. And column 1 is opposite column 4. Okay? The dotted lines aren't good for that, but that's what they are. You just bend it over. There are two ways of doing it. You can either bend under or bend over. But just don't look at columns 2 and 3. Don't revisit what they did to you. Look for your own mistakes. Okay? And here's where the big book says, where had I been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened? And those are your 4 character defects. And here's where we really need to look carefully at the definitions. Selfish has been defined by the big book consistently as wanting my way regardless of the motives. Of course you want not to have been abused or not to have been betrayed or not to have had bad things happen to other people. And your motives are good in not wanting bad things happen to you or bad things happen to other people. But you're selfish in this technical big book way in that you're trying to change the past, you're trying to change the present, you are frustrated because the life is not going on the way you want it to go. Call it self-will rather than selfish, but that's how the word selfish is. So at the very, very least, you are being selfish about horrible things that have happened to you or to others in that you wanted the past not to exist. That's what I wrote down for Hitler. I wanted Hitler not to have existed. I wanted the Holocaust not to have happened. And much more closer to the bone is, I want not to have been abused. I want not to have been betrayed. And sometimes that's the only way in which you're selfish or self-willed. Just you want things to have gone your way rather than the way they did. Sometimes that's the only. But as you write this down, you may discover that in some ways there are aspects of selfishness involved, not with abuse. But I'm just trying to think of examples. Well, here's the example I give that you can download. For the person who hurt me as a child, I want the past not to have happened. I want to have had a relatively painless childhood. I want to have had a protected childhood. I want my life to be different. No, that's not selfish by any dictionary definition, but it's self-willed. I want the past to be different from the way it was. I want my life to be different from the way it was. And that's playing God, and you can't. It's impossible. The person who didn't park within the lines. Selfish. Oh, people should think of other people's discomfort, and I don't want to be discomforted. That's selfish the ordinary way. I'll never be thin. Selfish. I want to be thin my own way. I want it to be easy. I want to be attractive. I want other people to think I'm really something. Well, that's selfish in a mixture of, I want to be healthy. See, I want to be healthy. Motives are good. I want to be healthy so I'll be around for my children and my grandchildren. That's okay. But I want to be attractive to other people. Your motives are a little more mixed there, right? So you may discover, you know, depending on the age of my children, my selfishness, my wanting my daughter to do well in school, well, at the age of when she was 10 or something, I just wanted her to do well in school when she was, well, I'm exaggerating, but if she was 25 and living at home, I want to do well in school so she wouldn't live at home anymore, you know? So, it, you know, your motives may be quite mixed or change as time goes on. You will, interestingly enough, discover some hidden motives that you didn't know for some of the things. So that's what selfish is. Dishonest. From the big book perspective and the big book stories, lying, cheating, stealing. That's the big book list of honesty issues. But from our point of view, from people who have been victims rather than victimizers, there are two aspects of dishonesty. They aren't discussed in the big book, but they certainly are aspects of dishonesty. One is lying to yourself about reality. I want the Holocaust not to have existed. That's selfish. Dishonest, it is finished before you were born. You're lying to yourself about reality. It was done. It's as if you're saying, I didn't want the Roman Empire to have existed. You know? And there's another part of dishonesty, which is not telling the truth when the truth should be told. We're people pleasers. I think I should change that, not telling the truth when the truth should and could be, or could and should be told. Because, you know, children very often can't tell the truth, or if they try, they're not believed or they're not listened to. But at a certain point, the truth can be told. And some of my friends came to the conclusion that they should have told the truth when they were about their abuse at a time when they would be believed or when they could be believed or when they could have done something. And they didn't. And certainly, people I've interviewed, the truth that they didn't tell was to their loved ones who were affected by their inability to be intimate, by their inability to hug, by their inability because they were so damaged by the abuse that they suffered that they couldn't be loving to their own children and their spouses. And they couldn't explain why, because they were so deeply shamed. The story of why they were shamed by something that someone did to them is itself an aspect of abuse in terms of what was said to them that made them so ashamed. But whatever it was, they grew up ashamed of what was done to them. So they couldn't even talk about it. So their inability to tell the truth was not necessarily to report the perpetrator, but just to be able to tell the truth to their own children about why mommy or daddy can't hug them. You know what I'm saying? Like it's sort of, and so they would identify that. I did this in AA. Why should I do this in OA? Selfish. I was comfortable in AA. I don't want to be uncomfortable. Dishonest. If AA were going to do the job, I would have done the job. Okay? Dishonest with I'll never be thin. There's a part of me that feels more comfortable being fat. I mean, I've heard people talk about that. I don't want to be a sex object, but I want to be a sex object. I mean, people have that double thing and push-pull kind of thing. With the person who hurt me as a child, dishonest, happened 40 years ago. I can't change the past. I didn't tell the truth when it happened, and I haven't told the truth to a number of people I should have told the truth to. Okay? That's deep stuff. I hope it doesn't trigger you. I hope it doesn't awaken issues with you. It's an aspect of healing that I hope can help you. What is self-seeking? That's the question. If you look up in a dictionary, self-seeking is selfish and selfish is self-seeking. I'll give you my interpretation from two perspectives. One is the word itself, self-seeking, seeking self. It is you define how I feel about myself. I'm going to look to you for my definition of who I am. So I'm searching for myself in you or whatever you did to me or whatever experience I had. My self-esteem depends on you, not on how I feel about my relationship with my higher power. The other hint is that it becomes in the sex conduct form inconsiderate. So self-seeking is thinking of myself and not of you. So if I, when I was younger, if I went out, before I was married, if I went out with a beautiful woman, part of going out with a beautiful woman was how good it made me look. So I was using her to make me look good. And that's, you know, that's inconsiderate. It's unfair. It's lacking in a real relationship. Self-seeking in terms of, say, the person who hurt me as a child, example, this changed how I felt and still feel about myself. I have felt damaged my whole life. the person who doesn't park within the lines, I don't deserve it happening to me. I don't deserve it. Self-seeking for the I'll never be thin. I want to be a sex object. I want to attract people. I feel stupid and awful and victimized the way I am. I'm throwing out examples. Self-seeking for the AA guy. I'm in the granddaddy of all the programs and I have to lower myself to be in this one. Ring a bell? People are suffering terribly in this world. Selfish, I want things to happen for the good for all people. Dishonest, I am indeed powerless over the fate of millions of other people. I waste my energies that could be used for good by spending my time thinking about things I am incapable of doing. And that's a very important one for me, actually. I'm paralyzed by my sense of helplessness when in fact I could be doing more if I didn't feel so helpless. If I weren't so paralyzed. Self-seeking. If I were in charge of the world, life would be better. So these are all just examples, and I've given examples. There's examples in the book I've written that you can download. I think there are examples in the outline that you've been given. And then frightened is just, are you full of fear? What are your fears? That it'll happen again? That I will never be loved? That I will be lonely? I mean, whatever the fears you have are. And these will make their way into the fear form. And it's been worth talking in detail about this, but I have to go on.
Why not just combine selfish and self-seeking? It's just so similar.
Because selfish has this special, the question is why not combine them? First of all, the big book doesn't. Secondly, self-seeking becomes inconsiderate in the sex conduct form, and selfish has this much broader concept of not just being selfish the dictionary way, but wanting my way.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So that's the only answer I can give you.
Thank you.
Excuse me. Now about fear, and I'm going to go quickly through this one. This is a magic form. It really is. You write down the people who create fear in you, either from column 3 or column 4. You write down the institutions and the principles who create fear in you, either in column 3 or column 4. Right, column 3 has, is fear involved, and column 4 has the frightened character defect part. You also write down other fears you may have. You may have fears of certain neighborhoods that you don't go to. You don't think about it all the time, but you are afraid of going to a particular neighborhood. You may be afraid of death. You may be afraid of flying. They're not things you think about, but if you do think about them, you have fears relating to them. You write down all your fears. Most of the fears will come from column 1 of your resentment form, because you will find that your character defect of fear comes up with most of the things on your resentment form. So you will write them down. And first you write down the persons, institutions, principles, and fears that you have in column 1, all the way down. And then you have these forms, and you write down, why do I have the fears? Some of it you've already written down under frightened in column 4. Right? You've already done that. So you'll be copying from column 4, or you may have greater fears. Why do I have fears relating to flying? I may crash. I don't know. I'm not afraid of flying, so it's hard for me to empathize. But I'm afraid of dying. Accidents are awful. What about my kids? You know, all the things that you're afraid of. I'm afraid of dying. When I put down I'm afraid of dying. Turned out I was afraid of not knowing what happens afterwards. I was more afraid, I think, of the process of dying than I was of dying. I didn't want to suffer pain. I didn't want to suffer degradation. I didn't want to suffer helplessness. When my daughter went on a trip with her girlfriend at the age of 19 to Europe, this was before internet, before when you had to sort of communicate using mail at the American Express or the Thomas Cook or something like that, they were going backpacking. They were two really young, beautiful-looking women, and I had fears relating to, well, the tent may flood, they may get in rain, they may have to spend times in railroad stations or bus stations. And then I thought, well, they may be, you know, people are going to hit on them. And then I thought, well, maybe they're going to have sexual assaults. And then I started thinking about, you know, being sold into slavery. And I mean, all these things were part of my list. And I realized at a certain point, a reasonable fear or concern can turn into an unreasonable one if you don't just isolate. And that's what will happen. As you write down in column two why this is, why you have fears in relation to this, you will no doubt go from the obvious and the reasonable to sometimes the ridiculous thing where the fears just begin to be all the fears that you have about life. At any rate, you vent yourself in that column. Why do I have the fear? The next two columns are gimmies. Where is my trust and reliance, on infinite God or my finite self? I think on my finite self. Because if I were relying on infinite God and my deepest values, I wouldn't feel the fear. And did self-reliance work? No, I don't think it did, because if it did work, I wouldn't feel fear. If I ever redo these forms, I'd combine the two and just put check marks in. So you've isolated the fears, you've explained why you've had them in point form, you've realized that it didn't work and that you're relying on yourself, and then the big book gives you the fear prayer. God, please remove my fear and direct my attention to what you would have me be. Not do, but be. It's very important. You might remember it from this graffito. To do is to be, Immanuel Kant. To be is to do, Nietzsche. Doobie, 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 Sammy Davis Jr. If you're old enough to remember Sammy Davis Jr. So, to be. What would my higher power have me be? So you say the prayer. I am afraid of this, or this is my fear. Name the fear. What would my higher power have me be? This may not be easy. The next column is, well, what would your higher power have you be in relation to this fear? You may not be able to come up with all kinds of ideas, but I can give you a whole bunch of suggestions. First of all, if you write it down as a person who is, a person who is, it helps you focus. And I'll give you some examples. My spouse. A loving, compassionate, understanding, honest, giving person who thinks of my spouse more than me and who invests in our relationship together. Person who hurt me as a child, the abuser. A person who is free from hate, regret, fear, who can trust and enjoy life, who does not live in the past, and who invests, and who does not deny love to others. Does that make sense?
Nice.
And, you know, my kids, a loving, compassionate, understanding, honest, giving parent who thinks of my children more than me and who invests in our relationship with each other. You see the patterns. People will suffer in this world. It's a principle that causes fear. A person who tries to help others and who is not paralyzed by what cannot be done and who is able to enjoy life on life's terms and accept happiness when happiness comes my way. Because I think that's what truth, love, justice, and beauty would have me be. And so, you know, the examples can go on and on, but you can see that sometimes it's an aspect of the serenity prayer. Basically, you're accepting what you can't change, and you're changing what you can and should. And this whole notion creates a completely different attitude towards your fears. You now have a strategy. Person afraid of flying. I don't have that listed as an example, but here's a person who's afraid of flying. A person who doesn't take unnecessary risks. A person who doesn't fly unless it's necessary. Why not? Or a person who does her best or his best to overcome a fear of flying because he or she must go on many plane trips. I mean, I'm just giving you examples. And suddenly, fear, which is paralyzing, becomes a strategy for reaction to life, which becomes maturity. You're no longer afraid, you're mature. You've grown up in relation to this fear, and you have a sense of what you can do in relation to that fear. I'm afraid of this area of town. What would my higher power have me be? a person who doesn't take unnecessary risks and who doesn't go to dangerous areas unless it's absolutely necessary. Seems like a reasonable approach to that issue. You know, my daughter was in Europe. I did my step 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9 on her. What would my higher power have me be in relation to a person that I cannot contact immediately? Phone connections, they're on the road, they're a loving father who makes sure that our daughter knows that he is available in case of any problem and who trusts her to do what's right and to take care of herself. What else can I be in relation to that? And the Big Book promises at once we outgrow fears. And I think that concept of maturity is right there. Fear is infantile. Strategy is maturity. So I think that's brilliant, personally. Okay. I'm going too quickly, but it's there. And you'll find all the words that I've just used, you'll find them in the section on fear. Now about sex. And again, sex is attraction. And the Big Book approach is to write down anyone you've hurt. Now, this doesn't have to be someone you've hurt sexually in the way we use the word sex now. It may be someone whom you denied affection to, who wanted to be affectionate with you. It may be someone whom you flirted with and shouldn't have flirted with. It may be someone whom you, it may be a celebrity whom you fantasized about to the exclusion of other people. You know, as kids, you know, whatever it is. It may be, it will almost certainly be someone, well, it may be a spouse, it may be a significant other as well. And many of these people will already have been on your resentment list, but some not. But you only write down whom I hurt, and you can see on the form, you know, there's a little box for whom you've hurt. And then you're asked the questions, where was I selfish, dishonest, and inconsiderate? Which is selfish, dishonest, self-seeking. So here are the other three character defects that we isolate in our resentment form, now being used to look at complicated relationships. Because when there's attraction between one person and another, or maybe one-sided or imbalanced in attraction, there's hurt. And that hurt is complex because your mind is thinking, but so is your body. And therefore, although probably familial relationships are the most complex, these are more difficult than an ordinary friendly relationship in which it's your mind talking, not your body as well. So the Big Book says, I don't know if the forms are clear, did I arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Maybe you did, maybe you didn't. Where was I at fault? What should I have done instead? The key question. Was I at fault? Invariably, my responses have been either invested more in the relationship, thought more of the other person, or got out of the relationship sooner. Invariably, those have been my answers. They may be different for you. But in so many of my relationships, I should have ended them earlier, and I didn't. I kept them on for my own purposes. And in others, with my spouse, I should have invested more, and I did, as a result. Thought more of the other person rather than of myself. And thus, I figure out an ideal, the Big Book says an ideal sex life, I figure out where I can live in a relationship now that is unselfish, in which my will isn't working its way, which is honest, in which I'm willing to tell the truth when the truth should be told, in which I'm willing to be realistic about what's possible and available, and in which I'm not hurtful and lying to people. And I can be considerate of another person, think of their needs more than mine, and not let them define me as to who I am. If I go out with a person because she's beautiful and she makes me feel handsome, that's objectifying that person. That's wrong. That's using that person for my self-seeking. If I consider it, I will not use that person for that purpose. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Here, okay. And the Big Book at that point says, on page 70, if we've been thorough about our personal inventory, we've written down a lot, right at the bottom, last paragraph there, We have listed and analyzed our resentments. We've begun to comprehend their futility and their fatality. We have commenced to see their terrible destructiveness. We've begun to learn tolerance, patience, and goodwill toward all men, even our enemies, for we look on them as sick people. Excuse me. We've listed the people we have hurt by our conduct and are willing to straighten out the past if we can. In this book, you read again and again that faith did for us what we could not do for ourselves. Excuse me. We hope you're convinced now that God can remove whatever self-will has blocked you off from him. That's a tortuous sentence, but that whole concept was blockage. Is back again. This whole concept of being blocked from the sunlight of the Spirit is right there. The grain cleaner, the plumber's helper, the whole concept of having that pipeline flow is right there. If you have already made a decision, an inventory of your grosser handicaps, grosser here does not mean yucky ones. It means the big ones, the obvious ones. This is not an exercise in subtlety here. It's what's clear and obviously bothering you. You have swallowed, you've made a good beginning, that being so, you've swallowed and digested some big chunks of truth about yourself. I tell you, frankly, if the way I've described it, it shouldn't take you that long to do this, if you dedicate yourself to doing it. You know, you could write down your resentments in one evening and a morning. You write down why they're on your list in one day, because you're just venting on paper. You could go through the check marks. When I say one day, I mean 3 or 4 hours. No matter if you have 180 resentments, it's just bang, bang, bang. And you can say ditto. You can write down 5 siblings if you have 5 siblings. And once you finish the first one, you can look at the next 4 and say, they're exactly the same. You know? And they are probably. Maybe there's one little variation here and there. You know? I was asked a question about, you know, people who've died and how you resent how they died and how you handle their death. And, I mean, when you write down why does this bother me? You write them down, their names down. They bother me. You know, they left loved ones. They could have gotten better and they chose to continue. The addictions or something like that. They chose to continue. They wouldn't listen to me. I could have saved them. You know, these are things that you could write down. And I do, frankly, right now, at times in relation to a friend of ours who has gone through some very difficult times with addiction. And, you know, it affects much of my self-esteem and, you know, all in third column. And I look at them and they're obviously sick people. They're obviously people who are sick, they're addicted. And I ask for the tolerance, pity, and patience that I cheerfully grant a sick person. They are sick people, a sick friend. They are friends. Why am I not granting them the same tolerance, pity, and patience that I would cheerfully grant a sick friend if they are, in fact, sick friends? Think about it. Where am I selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened? Selfish? I want the past not to have occurred. I wanted them not to be addicted. I wanted them not to die. Dishonest? They're dead. They were addicts. I could not save them. I'm lying to myself about reality. Or maybe I should have told them something that I didn't, but probably not. Self-seeking. Somehow they have diminished me. In their death, I feel diminished. My definition of myself has been affected by my constantly thinking about them. Frightened. I don't know. I'll turn out to be like them. Their children will suffer, continue to suffer. And when you go to the fear form, their children will suffer. What would my higher power have me be? As much of a substitute for their love as, you know, to help their children. Right? Isn't that a strategy? A person who is available for my nieces and my nephews. Or, you know, whatever it is. Or my friend's children or something like that. Okay? Any problems here? Can I go on? Okay. So we're running out of time. Step 5. Page 72. The big book says, now we're going to confess our problems to another person. We don't want to do this. Why should we do that? There are a lot of reasons. We'll give you one. You'll die if you don't. That's a pretty good reason. It's the only reason they give. I'll give you 3 other reasons. One is, confession is good for the soul. Obviously. Once you get something off your chest, you feel better. Second is, you will find that you are no different from the person you're giving your step five from, to. As a matter of fact, they will be able to say to you, been there, done that, got the t-shirt. You are no different. You're not uniquely different. You're not unique. You're the same. You're selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened. That's your problem. You have those character defects, and so is the person who's been listening to you. Third, if you ask for it, and I strongly advise you do, you can get some objectivity and feedback. Don't make sure it's not controlling feedback. I mean, when I give feedback, it's in the form of, would you think this or that? Or if I were you, I might have thought this about that. Does that ring a bell? You know, because I don't want to put thoughts into people's minds that aren't there. I just want them to recognize what's in their minds. But objectivity and feedback is sometimes very helpful. Now, the big book on page, right at the bottom of page 73 and on to page 74 talks about finding the right person to tell your story to, because this was written for people who didn't have AA around. Later on, when it talks about sponsoring, the big book says, make sure he knows you're available if he wants to make his decision, which is step three. Remember, the big book says step three is best done with a spiritual advisor. Or tell his story, which is step five. So clearly, within the fellowship, we often do step fives with each other. But the big book says you might want to do step five with your religious leader or with your or advisor or with your psychologist or with a good friend. The proviso is you do not do it with a person who's on your list. You know? Or if you do it with a person who's on your list, you don't do that part of it that relates to that person. You don't harm them. The rule the big book says on page 74 is we must be hard on others, on ourselves, but always considerate of others. And by the way, I think that rule means that we don't make amends to ourselves. But that's nothing. And they go on, right at the bottom, page 74, what are the criteria for the kind of person you're going to give it to? It is important that he be able to keep a confidence. That's one. Two, that he fully understand and approve what you're driving at. And on to page 75, that three, he will not try to change our plan. But we must not use this as a mere excuse to postpone. When we decide, page 75, who is to hear our story, we waste no time. We have a written inventory and we're prepared for a long talk. We explain to our partner what we're about to do and why we have to do it. He should realize that we are engaged upon a life and death errand. Most people approached in this way will be glad to help. They will be honored by our confidence. Now, I have been in a unique position. As a lawyer, I'm used to confidentiality, but my other unique position is I forget so quickly that, you know, if someone phones me a week later and said, you know that problem I was having with Robert? No, I don't. Who's Robert? Who are you? You know, I have this. But I'll never forget a person who came into my office when I had an office. I worked under my home after the last 10 years. She gave me a dollar. She said, now, you're my lawyer. Everything's confidential. And then she said, you realize that when we're finished, I'll have to kill you. And she was only half joking. So, when I sit down with people, or when I either to give it or to receive it, I say, this is life or death for me. You know, we explain to our partner what we're about to do, why we have to do it. He should realize we're engaged upon a life and death errand. This is life and death. This is very serious. Thank you. Thank you for the privilege of doing this with me. For your contribution to doing this with me. And here are the detailed, fulsome instructions of how to do step five. That's sarcasm. It's, if you watch The Big Bang Theory, sarcasm, you know. We pocket our pride. This is on page 75, right in the middle. We pocket our pride and go to it, illuminating every twist of character, every dark cranny of the past, period. It's the end of the instructions for how to do it. There are many different ways of doing it. I'll tell you what I do, and I'll tell you that it seems to be relatively successful. I say to people, keep columns 2 and 3 of the resentment form covered. I don't want you to take the inventory of the other person. I want to hear where you've been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened in relation to that person. And I'll tell you, that takes the fun out of it. Because, you know, the proliferation of celebrity magazines shows that we are all voyeurs in our own way. We all want to know what goes on in someone else's life. And column two is where we would get the nitty gritty. But I don't listen to the column two. If people feel the need to talk about column two, I'm not sure that they've gotten rid of their resentment such that they can isolate their own character defects. When someone says to me, before I tell you where I've been selfish this time, let me tell you what she did to me in the movie theater, and the, you know, I don't think you're ready yet. I say that, but the test is going to come in a few minutes. So I have them do that. Then I have them with the fear, and then I listen to them. And if they have gaps, if they don't know where they've been self-seeking, or they don't know where they've been frightened, I give some ideas and suggestions as to what they might be feeling. I ask them to tell me, is this your brother or the person you worked with for a week last summer? Because there's a big difference, right? So I like to know who they are, and it helps them. And what I find invariably is that people will be saying ditto after page 10. You know, just, yeah, well, here's another example. And you see, Pat, I just finished doing a step 5 with one of my sponsees, and it was amazing to see how he so easily and quickly saw the patterns in his character defects. It was just, you know, he had a lot of resentments, but it was pretty obvious they were all the same thing. Or not all the same thing, but they're all part and parcel of the same kind of thing. And, you know, Clancy, the great AA speaker, tells a story of he's driving a car, and it's raining and it's dark, it's at night, and some guy has a flashlight, and then Clancy, I did this, and then I did this, and then I did this, you know, all this emotion. Clancy says, does he know what I'm thinking? God, not another one, just like the other ones. Why can't, and then he says, I mean, it's sort of funny, it's also pretty awful. Why can't I get someone different? Why can't I get a murderer? You know? I mean, it's pretty awful when you think about it, but it is funny because it's boring. In its own way, it's boring. We all think, what's the word? We think we're terminally unique, right? Our uniqueness means that we're so different and it's killing us. And we're all the same, especially when you have these character defects of selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened. There are only a few variables within those, and they encompass everything. By the way, gossip. I mean, you've got all these other lists that people have. Gossiping, lust, jealousy, the seven deadly sins, which is a complete misreading of the AA 12 and 12, in which pride is the only thing that it's for, which is the selfishness that described in the big book. But anyway, that's another matter. You've got the list of 25, you've got the list of 60, you know, you've got all the questions of all your character defects. Well, I look at gossip, and I say, I gossip about a person. What is my character defect? Selfish. I want to feel better than the person I'm gossiping about. Dishonest. I'm not telling the whole truth about that person, because if I were, it wouldn't be gossip. And not that I'm lying, but I'm omitting truths so that he looks bad. Self-seeking. I want to look good, and I want him to look bad. And frightened that he'll find out about it. And I think that covers... I think that goes so much deeper than saying I'm a gossip or gossip is one of my character defects. I think gossip is a symptom of my character defects, as is isolation, as is fear of other people, as is my shyness. If I am shy, you may not believe it, but I am. Is my low self-esteem, and you may not believe I have low self-esteem, but I do. I think those are all aspects of selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened. And the more I have only four character defects, the more the patterns become obvious. And the more I can say ditto, ditto, ditto for column after column. So that's the resentment form. For the fear form, I say, to save time, I'm going to assume that you were relying on your finite self, it didn't work, and that you said the fear prayer. Name the fear, column one. Why is it on your list? Why do you have that fear? And what do you think your higher power would have you be in relation to it? A lot of people that call them who are doing this for the first time will not have a good idea about what their higher power would have them do, be. So I often will suggest, let's work it on a person who, you know. But that's part of the job, I think, or part of the role that a Step 5 listener can take. So it says conduct form, the person whom you've hurt, where you were selfish, dishonest, and inconsiderate, what you should have done instead. And you know what? I've had people with 180 resentments and lots of sex conduct issues and lots of fear issues, and I've never taken more than three and a half hours to listen to a Step 5. One thing I don't do, and I learned this very much from my first Step 5 listening to my first sponsee, was to say things like, gee, why is that on your list? That's nothing. It was a 10-hour Step 5, because that's what I had learned to do. Towards the end of the first 5 hours, I said that to him. Why, you know, this is a sex conduct issue. What's the problem with that? You shouldn't put that on your list. The next morning, this wise, wise young man said to me when we were meeting up, he said, listen, this is my inventory. It's not yours. And I feel bad about it. And I don't think it's fair for you to say that I shouldn't, you know, it shouldn't be on my list. Boy, did I learn a lesson from that. So I don't make judgments anymore. If people feel it, it's real for them. But I do make suggestions, but always tentatively, never telling them what they should think, because it's not up to me. First of all, I'm probably wrong. I'm just trying to open them up to their own ideas. That's all I'm trying to do. Now, the big book provides on page 75 the promises of this portion of Step 5. Once we have taken this step, withholding nothing, we are delighted. First promise, we are delighted. We can look the world in the eye. Second promise, we can look the world in the eye. Third promise, we can be alone at perfect peace and ease. And the fourth, our fears fall from us. Those are four definite guarantees, if you've done it right. The rest are beginning, and this may happen, this may not happen. But those four are absolutes. When I did this the big book way the first time with the guy who really, really read the big book, if you recall from my story yesterday or last night, he asked me that question. Are you delighted? Can you look the world in the eye? Can you be alone in perfect peace and ease? Have your fears fallen from you? I said, I don't think I've ever done a better Step 5, because remember, I'd been in relapse, so I'd gone through Step 5 quite a bit over the 7 years. I said, I don't think I've ever done a better one, but I really don't know whether I'm delighted or whether I can look the world in the eye. He said, think about it and tell me in the morning. So I phoned him in the morning and said, no, I don't feel like that. He said, you left something out. No, I didn't. I was thorough. He said, just pick up the resentment form and just see what happens. I had, I don't remember, 5 or 10 more pages of resentments. And then some of them were fears. I think the sex conduct form was finished. I didn't have any more sex conduct issues, but I certainly had more fears. And then he asked me the same question. I spent maybe a half an hour with him. Didn't have to spend any more. I'd already done most of it. Just a few more pages. Are you delighted? Can you look through the world? I'm not sure. I'll phone you tomorrow. No. You left something out. And this happened until I finished my fourth one. My fourth one, one of the resentments was, why am I filling out this murmur of form again? You know, because that was a real resentment. But at the end of it, I experienced delight to look the world in the eye. My fears could fall from and all that. So it's a very good test, because this is the moment at which, just before which, you're going to be asked whether you want to get rid of your defects of character. And unless you feel delighted, can look the world in the eye, can be alone in perfect peace and ease, it's going to be hard to think about giving them up. So it's a very good test. And again, you're just finessing it. You're just doing a little bit more in it. It's not as if you're redoing anything. So there may be a slight delay, but you can do it relatively quickly. We haven't finished our Step 5 yet, though, because there's one other aspect. We've admitted to ourselves, we've admitted to another human being, but there is admitting to our higher power. And the Big Book has instructions for that on the bottom of page 75. Returning home, we find a place where we can be quiet for an hour, carefully reviewing what we have done. So we're looking at all these forms again. We're looking at all that we've written. We thank God from the bottom of our heart that we know Him better. God, thank you from the bottom of my heart that I know you better. Taking this book down from our shelf, we turn to the page which contains the 12 steps. Blaine joked that there's so many literal big book thumpers that he could make $1 million creating a Step 5 big book shelf. taking this down from our shelf. Well, you need a shelf to take it down from. Why not have a dedicated Big Book Step 5 shelf? And he could make millions. It was funnier when he told it. Carefully reading the first five proposals, first five steps, we ask if we have omitted anything. God, have I omitted anything? For we're building an arch through which we shall walk a free man at last. The arch metaphor that you have that handout for. Is our work solid so far? Are the stones properly in place? Have we skimped in the cement, put in the foundation? Have we tried to make mortar without sand? Some people have tried to figure out what the hell those things mean. I think they're just masonry examples, and I don't want to get into any detail about what they mean. The fact is, are we complete? Now, if we're delighted, we can look the world in the eye, we can be alone in perfect peace and ease, and our fears have fallen from us, the chances are we have been complete, and we will say, yes, my character defects have been exposed, and I actually have seen the way to a life without those character defects. Turn the page, page 76. Same day, I think. Other people think it may take a day or so. But every big book thumper I know says it shouldn't take longer than a few days. If we can answer to our satisfaction, we then look at step 6. We've emphasized willingness as being indispensable. Are we now ready to let God remove from us all the things which we have admitted are objectionable? Can he now take them all, every one? Your answer, if you do the steps this way, will be, please. I think. That's the experience of almost everyone I know. You're not going to be sitting around, do I really, 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 am I really, 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 really ready? You know? You're going to say, my God, I've been living this life burdened by selfishness, dishonesty, self-seeking, and fear. Get it away from me. Hide thee hence. Someone lay a healing hand on me, you know, the healing of the preachers. Heal, you know, this guy, want them out of me. I want to be exercised. I'm positive that will happen, but the big book says if you still cling to something you won't let go, we ask God to help us to be willing. It doesn't say you stop. And I've seen too many people stay on step 6 until they're really, 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 really ready, and then they relapse. So please get on with it. I would say you do it the same night. Some of my big book thumpers friends say that you would really think about it for a couple of days. But don't think about it any longer than that. And then step 7 is just a prayer. Well, it's a great prayer, but it's only a prayer. Maybe it's not just the wrong word. It is a prayer. And let's say it. My Creator, I am now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen. I'm willing you should have all me, good and bad. Please remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows, so I can keep all the others if they're not standing in the way of my usefulness. It's a little loophole there. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. 6 and 7 were not in the original six steps. They're simply acceptance of the fact that I got to get rid of my character defects and an example of faith that as I work steps 8 and 9, my character defects will go away. Because the next words, and I would say at least you do step 7 right after you're really ready to do step 6. Like these, and Dr. Bob used to do them all in the same day. Dr. Bob, this charismatic individual, would say, you're a horrible person, aren't you? Yes. You've cheated on your wife and you've stolen from your employer, haven't you? Yes, Dr. Bob. Do you want God to remove all your defects of character? Yes, Dr. Bob. Get on your knees and ask God to remove. Okay, Dr. Bob. You know, I mean, it was, you know, there's a description of this. I've forgotten the page, but I can give it to you if you want. Where this guy says, in those 3 or 4 hours, we thoroughly went through my character defects and got rid of them. So Dr. Bob, with his charismatic personality, was able to do this. He was a saint-like kind of person, not to his children. His children were quite resentful of him for many years. But to everyone else, he was a saint. And Bill certainly thought of him as a saint. And he did it all this one day, take him through the steps. And, you know, there's a back-to-basics movement based on what Clarence did in Cleveland. There's a book written on it. There are a lot of back-to-basics meetings in AA where they do it in 4 weeks. And it's all the power of the group. You make public commitments to do things. You say prayers that are part of a ritual. And it has that same power of the charismatic aspect that Dr. Bob would give. But here are the instructions for doing it without a lot of hoopla. You know, it's just, you just do it. It's just things to be done. And you just do them. And the big book goes on. Now, the timetable says we finish at 4:20. Was there a reason it's 4:20 instead of 4:30? Do we have to leave here at 4:30?
No. Just so we could theoretically finish at 4:30.
All right. Could you give me, would it be possible, so at least I finish step 9?
Yes.
I think I can do it if you give me about 15 minutes.
Yes.
Amends. First of all, very quickly, the word amends is a singular and plural. There's no noun of amend. Sadly, there should be. But you say, I make an amends. And you can, I can make many amends, I make an amends. I hate it, but it's true. Secondly, until you know the harm you've done to another person, you do not know the kind of amends you have to make. There's a form here. Maybe it could be passed out. It's a step 8 and 9 list. It is, in a sense, from the big book, in a sense it's not. But I give it to you for your own, it might help you. Might not, but it might. Every person you've harmed, you have to analyze what harm you did. The harm I did to Hitler was allow him to continue to do the horrible things that he did in my mind. Allow him to paralyze my thinking, allow him to keep me from doing good to others because I was so living in the past, I was so obsessed with what had happened that I could never get out of my, I couldn't get out of myself. And my amends was to spread love and to say the truth when the truth should be told to people who were spreading hatred and fear, because I saw that as the way of that Hitler got into power. I was obsessed with concerns about hatred and fear giving rise to the kind of actions that occurred in Nazi Germany. So my amends to Hitler was not to let him continue to live rent-free in my mind and to stand up for truth, love, justice, and beauty in my life. Now, you might say, what kind of an amends? Well, that's what made sense to me. The big book divides amends. There are three different kinds of direct amends, and they are increasingly more responsible depending on the kind of harm that was done. You can see in the schematic outline, I've written them out, they go through them twice. Once in terms of discussing the amends, secondly in terms of whether harm would result if you made the amends. So on page, I just want to read page 76, right in the middle. Now we need more action, without which we find that faith without works is dead. So it's all well at step 7 to say a prayer, but it's meaningless if you don't take more action. And that's what the big book says. Step 7 may show faith that God will remove your defects of character, but there ain't no works in there. The works are steps 8 and 9. And anyone who waits for their defects of character to be removed at step 7 is missing the importance of steps 8 and 9. Because the real promises from the big book perspective come at the end, in the middle, and at the end of step 9. Those are the real promises, and I hope we get to them today. So, page 76 to the middle of page 78 is what I would call the eyeball-to-eyeball amends. The direct, I am sorry for what I have done. You do not talk about the other person's faults. They may have done horrible things, but you only talk about yours. Now remember, 8 and 9 are separated. So in 8, we talk about what we would say and we become willing to say it, even if we're never going to say it. You know? The amends, I mean, I've had friends who were victims of spousal abuse. Their amends to their ex-husbands were, I am sorry that after the first or second hit, I did not leave you, take the kids, call the police on you, and force you to see a psychiatrist, but instead let you push me around, hit me and beat me for 7 more years, thinking that I could do something, that love would triumph. I mean, that's quite an amends, quite an apology. But I would say that no one should ever make it. But they should be willing to. If that husband ever came to her and said, I did horrible things to you, I can't tell, I want to make it up, you know, then that person could say, my side of the street is that I didn't try and stop you earlier. Not that that excuses you, and I'm glad that you're apologizing to me, but I'm sorry I didn't do something. So, but you wouldn't make that amends because you would, you know, if the person was still an abusive person, you might be putting that person in danger as well as yourself.
Yes.
And if you put yourself in danger, your loved ones will be harmed as well. So you wouldn't make that amends, but you would be willing to make the amends. You gossiped about a person. I told true stories about that person, and he doesn't know I told him. What good does it do for me to say, I ridiculed you for about 5 years? You don't know it, but I ridiculed you for 5 years. I told true stories about you, but I held them up to ridicule. I'm sorry. What I did was, whenever people want him, he was really a worthy person of being made fun of because of his quirks, I would say, worthy is the wrong word. People easily wanted to make fun of him. I would say, you know what? I think what we're laughing at, or what, you know, is really some character problems he has and some personality issues he has, and I don't think it's fair to make fun of him. So I became a wet blanket. And I do that in gossip generally. I don't want to hear gossip. That's the amends I make to him. If he ever says, and he won't, but if he ever said to me, I hear you gossip about me for years and you told stories about me, I would say, yes, I didn't know you knew. Now that I know you know, I'll tell you how sorry I am, and I'll tell you the efforts I made to change. Okay? So the first kind of amends is eyeball to eyeball. You're cleaning off your side of the street. The Big Book promises that no matter what the reaction the other person has, you will be gratified by the result. And that happened to me. I made amends to a person who basically dismissed me. I don't remember that, and basically said, please get out of my office. I knew he remembered it. I knew he, you know. But I was lifted up. It was a person who was like an older brother to me, and I felt lifted. I no longer had the burden of what I had done to him. He was living with his inability to be in the same room with me, but I no longer was living with the inability to be in the room with him. And whenever I saw him, or whenever I had an opportunity, I didn't do this on purpose, but I would treat him with respect, with the kind of love I used to treat him with, and I would think of him and things like that. Well, within 7-8 years, he was friendly again. But he certainly wasn't friendly that day, and yet I walked out floating on air. Because it's a big thing for me to apologize for. The second direct amends, in the middle of page 78, that paragraph in the middle, money, restitution. Clearly, if you've taken money from another person or caused that person financial or physical harms, you have to make up for it. And apologizing isn't enough. You have to repay the money or make some kind of restitution to put that person back in the position that he or she would have been had you not done the harm. And the third kind of harm is at the bottom of page 78 to the top of page 79. You may have offended the public good. You may have gone beyond just that one person and harmed a group of people or harmed or broken a law or gossiped about someone to harm that person's reputation, an apology isn't enough. You may have to turn yourself into the police. You may have to confess that you stole from your company, even though the company doesn't know about it and you're still working for them. I mean, these are all things you may have to be willing to do. You may not do them, but you have to be willing to do them. And the Big Book says on page 79, although, the first full paragraph there, although these reparations take innumerable forms, There are some general principles which we find guiding. Reminding ourselves that we have decided to go to any lengths to find a spiritual experience, we ask God that we be given strength and direction to do the right thing, no matter what the personal consequences may be. We may lose our position or reputation or face jail, but we are willing, we have to be, we must not shrink at anything. So you can see how the amends are a spectrum from direct apology all the way to public acknowledgement of what I have done and taking on the, you know, taking on more of the public. And, you know, if you've been the victim of abuse, your amends will be much more subtle than, you know, I'm sorry I stole from you when I was a kid, from the store when I stole candy from the store, right? They'll be subtle and you may not have to make them. I've had three friends who were victims of child abuse, sexual abuse, and each one of them did something different. One of them went to the police. In Canada, there's no statute of limitations on sexual assaults. Went to the police. The second one announced at a family party, "This uncle abused me. Don't let your children alone with him." And the third one said, "He's 95 years old. He's dying alone. There's nothing I have to do. He's dug his own grave." Now, say, how could you go to the police? Won't that harm that person? Well, the answer is, if your child or any child is about to jump off a cliff, and the only way to save that child is to grab the arm and break the arm, but still save the child, lesser harm for a greater good. And if it's true that a person who harms others is harming his own or her own soul, in a sense, that person is digging a bigger grave, then in fact, by stopping that person, you are helping that person and you're also helping the people who might have been victimized. Mm-hmm. So it's very subtle. I would never, ever do this without consulting with other people. You can be too hard on yourself and you can be too easy on yourself. So that's the three kinds of direct amends. We'll find that there's also living amends, but three kinds of direct amends. And then the big book revisits them in the context on page 79 with usually other people will be involved. And remember, step 9 says, we made such direct amends wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. So the big book now goes back to those three concepts and revisits them, but in a different order. The first order is the person who owes money to his first wife. This is the restitution one, the second one that we discussed. If he pays his first wife, he starves his second family. He does what he can. He agrees to pay money, but only slowly, because he cannot pay it all at once, because it would harm others. Page 80, the public consequences, the guy who gossips and takes money and tells people he never got the money and ruined the person's reputation in the town. He gets up and he consults with his business partner and with his family because he doesn't want them to be harmed by what he's about to do. They give him the go-ahead and he gets up in church and confesses what he had done. It never says he paid back the money, but I hope he did. And the last one is right at the bottom of page 80 to the middle of page 82, and that's a direct apology. And they say, if you have been having an affair, do you tell your wife? And the answer is, if she doesn't know about it, maybe you should just stop doing it. And yeah, I know some people read this, oh, that's Bill Wilson, he had affairs, and he's trying to sort of get out of it. But the fact is, won't you hurt a person to tell them about things they don't know? Hi, Mom, I've hated you for 20 years. You reform your life. You change what you've done that is harmful, but you may not tell. If she knows about it, they say, and presses you for details, you don't give the details because that involves another person. And these are just examples. I'm not suggesting that they're the right examples or that this person worked it out the way that you would work it out. Every person has to work it out for himself or herself. But what's important is that you give thought to, whom did I hurt? How did I hurt that person? What kind of amends can I possibly make to that person? Should I make those amends or would it harm other people? Not yourself, but other people. Okay? And get advice. Get experience from other people. Those are the three direct amends. Now we go to the living amends. The big book says you can't just apologize to the people you live with and to the people you work with and to the people you have constant contact with. You've got to change and you've got to be an example of the kind of person that you should have been. Because you can't just sort of apologize. And that example goes from page, as I said, up to page 82. It starts on page 82 in the middle, and it goes down to the middle of page 83. So that's living amends. And then there's wrongs we can't make. And they say we don't worry about them if we can honestly say to ourselves that we would right them if we could. And I gotta tell you, there are people I'd love to make amends to, but it's of no value, in my opinion, it would be harmful for me to go back and say, hey, remember me from 50 years ago and that little incident where I caused you a little bit of pain and grief? I'm really sorry, remember that? Do you really remember it? You know, let me tell you all about it so you'll remember how humiliated you were. You know, what's the value of that? We send an honest letter if they're not available to us. People, for dead people, they go to the gravestone, they write a letter, they read the letter, they burn the letter. That has symbolic value for a lot of people. I have conversations with dead people in my mind. Only when I'm doing amends. And that seems to work for me. The idea of being symbolically, you know, going to gravestone, but for a lot of people that makes sense. The big book says we should be sensible, tactful, considerate, and humble without being servile or scraping. The image there is, if you're familiar with David Copperfield, you know, this Uriah Heep's, I'm very humble. I'm very humble. You know, sort of taking pride in his humility. As God's people, we stand on our own feet. We don't crawl before anyone. Two comments, and then I'm going to read the promises and we'll go on to tomorrow. We'll finish for today. One is, nowhere in the big book do you make amends to yourself. You know, we hear in the program, the first thing I got to do is make amends to myself. I think I know what that means for many of us. It means I got to start saying no. I got to start being a doormat. It's late. And I need time to myself. I deserve time to myself. I'm always doing things for other people. I need time for the bath, for the incense, or whatever it is. I agree. But look at it the other way. From the big book perspective, because you don't say no to people, you're enabling them. If you do laundry for people who are perfectly capable of doing laundry for themselves, let them have dirty clothes if they aren't going to do the laundry. Let them learn from this. You're not teaching them a lesson they should be learning. Do it for their sake, not for yours. Say no for their sake, not for yours. And yes, you do need time to yourself. Everyone needs a time to veg out and to refurbish and re-energize herself or himself. And we do need time to ourselves to do that, because if we're helping other people all the time, we need time to ourselves so we can do a better job of helping other people. But look at it as an amends to other people, not yourself, and you'll be more in spirit with the big book. Okay? The other thing, I just want to tell a story. And what is the amends you make to yourself in the end? You're going to be a different person. You're going to be a person who can look at other people eat the foods you used to eat and not want to eat them. You're going to be a person who's full of serenity and love. And I'll read those promises in a moment. I just want to tell you one story that is hard to tell, but it's worth it. We're in the middle of the holy days of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, or Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur is the Day of Atonement. It's the day where you prostrate yourself before God and ask for forgiveness. And in this small little shtetl, the shtetl is like where Tevye lives in Fiddler on the Roof, little enclave in Russia. Shtetl means little town. There's a small little synagogue, very small number of Jews, and it's Yom Kippur, and they're in the synagogue, they're all gathered, and the rabbi gets up, says, God, before you, I am nothing, I'm nothing! And he falls on his face, and he's, I'm nothing, I'm nothing. Then the richest man in town gets up, says, God, before you, I am nothing, I'm nothing! And he falls on his face, I'm nothing, I'm nothing. And then the town beggar gets up. He says, God, before you, I am nothing. I am nothing. And he falls on his face. I'm nothing. I'm nothing. And the rich man whispers to the rabbi, look who thinks he's nothing. That's this whole we should be sensible, servile, not scraping. I mean, if you're proud that you're humble, you're not humble. You know, and the rich man was not that humble. Okay, I'm going to read two sets of promises. One of them come halfway through step 9, and they're wonderful, and they're the ones we know about. And then I'm going to read the promises that come after a discussion of step 10, but clearly are part of the effect of finishing step 9. If we are painstaking about this phase of our development, bottom page 83, if we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity. We will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. I'm going to stop for a moment and just point out, the big book in another place says, our darkest past is our greatest possession. With it, we can bring recovery to others. I have friends who have suffered the most horrible childhood traumas and are able to say, as I cannot, hey, these things happened to me when I was a kid and I don't eat over them. So stop whining. You know? No, I can't say that. I would never say that. I might say, do you want some cheese with your wine? But that's another issue. But since I'm a vegan, I don't do that anymore. But you know what I'm saying? People like that, people who have suffered, can at least transform the hurt and the horror into something that can inspire another person to work the steps and find their own serenity. I don't say that that's deliberate or that that's was fated to happen. I obviously don't believe that. But at least you can change and how your dark past can benefit others. And I would never call that a gift, but at least it is a transformation of hurt into hope. And if you work the steps, you will see that you uniquely can help someone if you have suffered horribly. You know, I haven't lost 300 pounds. I haven't been abused. I haven't had the history that so many of us in this program have had. Imagine the hope you can give to others that I cannot give. I can talk well, but I can't give that same hope that others can give in this program. And you have that opportunity, if you have suffered a great deal, to show how you have overcame that suffering and you can bring hope to people who are dying. Anyway, I want to point that out. So I'll just finish that. We will lose interest in that feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things, gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing this for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? Yeah, I don't do that, but I know a lot of people do. They're being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, spiritual experience, sometimes slowly, spiritual awakening. But they will always materialize when we work them. They're great promises. We hear them read, we talk about them. That's not why I came into this program. I came into this program for what are called the hidden promises. Hidden, they're in full view, but no one reads them. Bottom of page 84. And we have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol. For by this time, sanity will have returned. We will seldom be interested in liquor and our killer foods, our binge foods. If tempted, we recoil from it as from a hot flame. We react sanely and normally. We will find that this has happened automatically. We will see that our new attitude toward liquor has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. That's the miracle of it. We're not fighting it, neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we've been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We haven't even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. It doesn't exist for us. We're neither cocky nor are we afraid. That is our experience. And then comes the proviso. That's how we react, so long as we keep in fit spiritual condition. I came to OA for recovery from compulsive eating, not for recovery from spiritual injuries. I came to stop eating compulsively. And the people who appealed to me, the people who gave me hope, were the people who said, I can be around this stuff and not want it. They're the ones who gave me the hope. And of course, if they had suffered a great deal and still had that, they gave me even more hope. But I can tell you that these are the promises that OA does not talk about enough. And we have to talk about tomorrow why that's the case and how important it is to talk about. Good night. See you tomorrow.